as an intrusion of the flesh which men and gaolers all suffer, a sickness, no more. Paul turned, studied the gaoler's eyes, those pitted, steely balls without expression. What visions did those eyes see?
Duncan. Duncan,
Paul whispered.
I am called Hate.
I saw a moon fall, Paul said. It was gone, destroyed. I heard a great hissing. The earth shook.
You are drunk on too much time, the gaoler said.
I ask for the Zensuni and I get the Mentat, Paul said. Very well. Play my vision through your logic, Mentat. Analyze it, and reduce it to mere words laid out for burial.
Burial indeed, the gaoler said.
You run from death. You strain at the next instant, refuse to live here and now.
Augury. What a crutch for an emperor.
Paul found himself fascinated by a well-remembered mole on the gaoler's chin.
Trying to live in this future, the gaoler said.
Do you give substance to such a future?
Do you make it real?
If I go the way of my vision future, I'll be alive, then, Paul muttered. What makes you think I want to live there?
The gaoler shrugged.
You ask me for a substantial answer.
Where is there substance in a universe composed of events? Paul asked. Is there a final answer? Doesn't each solution produce new questions?
You've digested so much time you have delusions of immortality, the gaoler said. Even your empire, my lord, must live its time and die.
Don't parade smoke-blackened altars before me, Paul growled. I've heard enough sad histories of gods and messiahs. Why should I need special powers to forecast ruins of my own like all those others? The lowliest servant of my kitchens could do this.
He shook his head.
The moon fell.
You've not brought your mind to rest at its beginning, the gaoler said.
Is that how you destroy me? Paul demanded. Prevent me from collecting my thoughts?
Can you collect chaos? The gaoler asked. We Zensuni say, not collecting. That is the ultimate gathering. What can you gather without gathering yourself?
I'm deviled by a vision and you spew nonsense, Paul raged. What do you know of prescience?
I've seen the oracle at work, the gaoler said. I've seen those who seek signs and omens for their individual destiny. They fear what they seek.
My falling moon is real, Paul whispered.
He took a trembling breath.
It moves. It moves.
Men always fear things which move by themselves, the gaoler said. You fear your own powers. Things fall into your head from nowhere. When they fall out, where do they go?
You comfort me with thorns, Paul growled.
An inner illumination came over the gaoler's face. For a moment, he became pure Duncan Idaho.
I give you what comfort I can, he said.
Paul wondered at that momentary spasm. Had the gaoler felt grief which his mind rejected? Had Hate put down a vision of his own?
My moon has a name, Paul whispered.
He let the vision flow over him then. Though his whole being shrieked, no sound escaped him. He was afraid to speak, fearful that his voice might betray him. The air of this terrifying future was thick with Cheney's absence. Flesh that had cried in ecstasy, eyes that had burned him with their desire, the voice that had charmed him because it played no tricks of subtle control, all gone, back into the water and the sand.
Slowly, Paul turned away, looked out at the present and the plaza before Aliyah's temple. Three shaven-headed pilgrims entered from the processional avenue. They wore grimy yellow robes and hurried with their heads bent against the afternoon's wind. One walked with a limp, dragging his left foot. They beat their way against the wind, rounded a corner, and were gone from his sight. Just as his moon would go, they were gone. Still, his vision lay before him. Its terrible purpose gave him no choice.
The flesh surrenders itself, he thought. Eternity takes back its own. Our bodies stirred these waters briefly, danced with a certain intoxication before the love of life and self, dealt with a few strange ideas, then submitted to the instruments of time. What can we say of this? I occurred. I am not. Yet, I occurred.
You do not beg the sun for mercy. Muad'Dib's Travail, from the Stilgar Commentary. One moment of incompetence can be fatal, the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam reminded herself. She hobbled along, apparently unconcerned, within a ring of Fremen guards. One of those behind her, she knew, was a deaf mute, immune to any wiles of voice. No doubt he'd been charged to kill her at the slightest provocation. Why had Paul summoned her, she wondered. Was he about to pass sentence? She remembered the day long ago when she'd tested him, the child Kwisatz Haderach. He was a deep one. Damn his mother, for all eternity. It was her fault the Bene Gesserit had lost their hold on this gene line. Silence surged along the vaulted passages ahead of her entourage. She sensed the word being passed. Paul would hear the silence. He'd know of her coming before it was announced. She didn't delude herself with ideas that her powers exceeded his. Damn him! She begrudged the burdens age had imposed on her, the aching joints, responses not as quick as once they'd been, muscles not as elastic as the whipcords of her youth. A long day lay behind her, and a long life. She'd spent this day with the Dún Taro in a fruitless search for some clue to her own fate, but the cards were sluggish. The guards herded her around a corner into another of the seemingly endless vaulted passages. Triangular metaglass windows on her left gave a view upward to trellised vines and indigo flowers in deep shadows cast by the afternoon sun. Tiles lay underfoot, figures of water creatures from exotic planets, water reminders everywhere. Wealth. Riches. Robed figures passed across another hall in front of her, cast covert glances at the Reverend Mother. Recognition was obvious in their manner, and tension. She kept her attention on the sharp hairline of the guard immediately in front, young flesh, pink creases at the uniform collar. The immensity of this Aegir citadel began to impress her. Passages, passages. They passed an open doorway from which emerged the sound of timbre and flute playing soft elder music. A glance showed her blue-in-blue Fremen eyes staring from the room. She sensed in them the ferment of legendary revolts stirring in wild genes. There lay the measure of her personal burden, she knew. A Bene Gesserit could not escape awareness of the genes and their possibilities. She was touched by a feeling of loss. That stubborn fool of an Atreides. How could he deny the jewels of posterity within his loins? A Kwisatz Haderach, born out of this time, true, but real as his abomination of a sister. And there lay a dangerous unknown. A wild Reverend Mother spawned without Bene Gesserit inhibitions, holding no loyalty to orderly development of the genes. She shared her brother's powers, no doubt. And more. The size of the citadel began to oppress her. Would the passages never end? The place reeked of terrifying physical power. No planet, no civilization in all human history had ever before seen such man-made immensity. A dozen ancient cities could be hidden in its walls. They passed oval doors with winking lights. She recognized them for Ixian handiwork, pneumatic transport orifices. Why was she being marched all this distance, then? The answer began to shape itself in her mind. To oppress her in preparation for this audience with the Emperor. A small clue, but it joined other subtle indications, the relative suppression and selection of words by her escort, the traces of primitive shyness in their eyes when they called her Reverend Mother. The cold and bland, essentially odorless nature of these halls, all combined to reveal much that a Bene Gesserit could interpret. Paul wanted something from her. She concealed a feeling of elation. A bargaining lever existed. It remained only to find the nature of that lever and test its strength. Some levers had moved things greater than this citadel. A finger's touch had been known to topple civilizations. The Reverend Mother reminded herself then of Cytale's assessment. When a creature has developed into one thing, he will choose death rather than change into his opposite. The passages through which she was being escorted grew larger by subtle stages, tricks of arching, graduated amplification of pillared supports, displacement of the triangular windows by larger, oblong shapes. Ahead of her, finally, loomed double doors centered in the far wall of a tall antechamber. She sensed that the doors were very large and was forced to suppress a gasp as her trained awareness measured out the true proportions. The doorway stood at least 80 meters high, half that in width. As she approached with her escort, the doors swung inward, an immense and silent movement of hidden machinery. She recognized more Ixion handiwork. Through that towering doorway she marched with her guards into the grand reception hall of the Emperor Paul Atreides, Muad'Dib, before whom all people are dwarfed. Now she saw the effect of that popular saying at work. As she advanced toward Paul on the distant throne, the Reverend Mother found herself more impressed by the architectural subtleties of her surroundings than she was by the immensities. The space was large. It could have housed the entire citadel of any ruler in human history. The open sweep of the room said much about hidden structural forces balanced with nicety. Trusses and supporting beams behind these walls and the faraway domed ceiling must surpass anything ever before attempted. Everything spoke of engineering genius. Without seeming to do so, the hall grew smaller at its far end, refusing to dwarf Paul on his throne centered on a dais. An untrained awareness, shocked by surrounding proportions, would see him at first as many times larger than his actual size. Colors played upon the unprotected psyche. Paul's green throne had been cut from a single Hagar emerald. It suggested growing things and, out of the Fremen mythos, reflected the mourning color. It whispered that here sat he who could make you mourn. Life and death in one symbol, a clever stress of opposites. Behind the throne, draperies cascaded in burnt orange, curried gold of dune earth, and cinnamon flecks of melange. To a trained eye, the symbolism was obvious, but it contained hammer blows to beat down the uninitiated. Time played its role here. The Reverend Mother measured the minutes required to approach the Imperial Presence at her hobbling pace. You had time to be cowed. Any tendency toward resentment would be squeezed out of you by the unbridled power which focused down upon your person. You might start the long march toward that throne as a human of dignity, but you ended the march as a gnat. Aides and attendants stood around the Emperor in a curiously ordered sequence. Attentive household guardsmen along the draped back wall. That abomination, Alia, 2 steps below Paul and on his left hand. Stilgar, the imperial lackey, on the step directly below Alia. And on the right, 1 step up from the floor of the hall, a solitary figure, the fleshly revenant of Duncan Idaho, the Gola. She marked older Fremen among the guardsmen, bearded naibs with stillsuit scars on their noses, sheathed kriss knives at their waists, a few Mauler pistols, even some laser guns. Those must be trusted men, she thought, to carry laser guns in Paul's presence when he obviously wore a shield generator. She could see the shimmering of its field around him. 1 burst of a laser gun into that field and the entire citadel would be a hole in the ground. Her guard stopped 10 paces from the foot of the dais, parted to open an unobstructed view of the Emperor. She noted now the absence of Chaney and Irulan, wondered at it. He held no important audience without them, so it was said. Paul nodded to her, silent, measuring. Immediately she decided to take the offensive, said, "So? The great Paul Atreides deigns to see the one he banished." Paul smiled wryly, thinking, "She knows I want something from her." That knowledge had been inevitable, she being who she was. He recognized her powers. the Bene Gesserit didn't become Reverend Mothers by chance.
"Shall we dispense with fencing?" he asked.
Would it be this easy? She wondered. And she said,
"Name the thing you want."
Stilgar stirred, cast a sharp glance at Paul. The Imperial lackey didn't like her tone.
"Stilgar wants me to send you away," Paul said.
"Not kill me?" she asked. "I would have expected something more direct from a Fremen naib."
Stilgar scowled, said,
"Often I must speak otherwise than I think. That is called diplomacy."
"Then let us dispense with diplomacy as well," she said. "Was it necessary to have me walk all that distance? I am an old woman."
"You had to be shown how callous I can be," Paul said. "That way you will appreciate magnanimity."
"You dare such gaucheries with a Bene Gesserit?" she asked.
"Gross actions carry their own messages," Paul said.
She hesitated, weighed his words. So, he might yet dispense with her. Grossly, obviously, if she what?
"Say what it is you want from me," she muttered.
Alia glanced at her brother, nodded toward the draperies behind the throne. She knew Paul's reasoning in this, but disliked it all the same. Call it wild prophecy. She felt pregnant with reluctance to take part in this bargaining.
"You must be careful how you speak to me, old woman," Paul said.
"He called me old woman when he was a stripling," the Reverend Mother thought. "Does he remind me now of my hand in his past? The decision I made then, must I remake it here?"
She felt the weight of decision, a physical thing that set her knees to trembling, muscles cried their fatigue.
"It was a long walk," Paul said, "and I can see that you're tired. We will retire to my private chamber behind the throne. You may sit there."
He gave a hand signal to Stilgar, arose. Stilgar and the Gola converged on her, helped her up the steps, followed Paul through a passage concealed by the draperies. She realized then why he had greeted her in the hall. A dumb show for the guards and naibs. He feared them then. And now he displayed kindly benevolence, daring such wiles on a Bene Gesserit. Or was it daring? She sensed another presence behind, glanced back to see Alia following. The younger woman's eyes held a brooding, baleful cast. The Reverend Mother shuddered. The private chamber at the end of the passage was a 20-meter cube of plasmeld, yellow glow globes for light, the deep orange hangings of a desert still tent around the walls. It contained divans, soft cushions, a faint odor of melange, crystal water flagons on a low table. It felt cramped, tiny after the outer hall. Paul seated her on a divan, stood over her, studying the ancient face, steely teeth, eyes that hid more than they revealed, deeply wrinkled skin. He indicated a water flagon. She shook her head, dislodging a wisp of grey hair.
In a low voice, Paul said, "I wish to bargain with you for the life of my beloved."
Stilgar cleared his throat. Alia fingered the handle of the kris knife sheathed at her neck. The Gola remained at the door, face impassive, metal eyes pointed at the air above the Reverend Mother's head.
"Have you had a vision of my hand in her death?" the Reverend Mother asked.
She kept her attention on the Gola, oddly disturbed by him. Why should she feel threatened by the Gola? He was a tool of the conspiracy.
"I know what it is you want from me," Paul said, avoiding her question.
"Then he only suspects," she thought.
The Reverend Mother looked down at the tips of her shoes exposed by a fold of her robe. Black, black. Shoes and robe showed marks of her confinement, stains, wrinkles. She lifted her chin, met an angry glare in Paul's eyes. Elation surged through her, but she hid the emotion behind pursed lips, slitted eyelids.
"What coin do you offer?" she asked.
"You may have my seed, but not my person," Paul said. "Irulan, banished and inseminated by artificial—"
"You dare?"
The Reverend Mother flared, stiffening. Stilgar took a half step forward. Disconcertingly, the Gola smiled. And now Alia was studying him.
"We'll not discuss the things your sisterhood forbids," Paul said. "I will listen to no talk of sins, abominations, or the beliefs left over from past jihads. You may have my seed for your plans, but no child of Irulan's will sit on my throne."
"Your throne," she sneered.
"My throne."
"Then who will bear the imperial heir?"
"Chaney."
"She is barren."
"She is with child."
An involuntary indrawn breath exposed her shock.
"You lie,"
she snapped. Paul held up a restraining hand as Stilgar surged forward.
"We've known for 2 days that she carries my child."
"But Irulan—"
"By artificial means only. That's my offer."
The Reverend Mother closed her eyes to hide his face.
Damnation. To cast the genetic dice in such a way.
Loathing boiled in her breast. The teaching of the Bene Gesserit, the lessons of the Butlerian Jihad, all proscribed such an act. One did not demean the highest aspirations of humankind. No machine could function in the way of a human mind. No word or deed could imply that men might be bred on the level of animals.
"Your decision," Paul said.
She shook her head. The genes. The precious Atreides genes. Only these were important. Need went deeper than prescription. For the sisterhood, mating mingled more than sperm and ovum. One aimed to capture the psyche. The Reverend Mother understood now the subtle depths of Paul's offer. He would make the Bene Gesserit party to an act which would bring down popular wrath, were it ever discovered. They could not admit such paternity if the Emperor denied it. This coin might save the Atreides' genes for the sisterhood, but it would never buy a throne. She swept her gaze around the room, studying each face. Stilgar, passive and waiting now, the Gola frozen at some inward place, Alia watching the Gola, and Paul, wrath beneath a shallow veneer.
"This is your only offer?"
she asked.
"My only offer."
She glanced at the Gola, caught by a brief movement of muscles across his cheeks. Emotion?
"You, Gola," she said. "Should such an offer be made? Having been made, should it be accepted? Function as the mentat for us?"
The metallic eyes turned to Paul.
"Answer as you will," Paul said.
The Gola returned his gleaming attention to the Reverend Mother, shocked her once more by smiling.
"An offer is only as good as the real thing it buys," he said. "The exchange offered here is life for life, a high order of business."
Alia brushed a strand of coppery hair from her forehead, said,
"And what else is hidden in this bargain?"
The Reverend Mother refused to look at Alia, but the words burned in her mind. Yes, far deeper implications lay here. The sister was an abomination, true. But there could be no denying her status as a Reverend Mother with all the title implied. Gaius Helen Mohiam felt herself in this instant to be not one single person, but all the others who sat like tiny congeries in her memory. They were alert, every Reverend Mother she had absorbed in becoming a priestess of the sisterhood. Alia would be standing in the same situation here.
"What else?" the Gola asked. "One wonders why the witches of the Bene Gesserit have not used Tleilaxu methods."
Gaius Helen Mohiam and all the Reverend Mothers within her shuddered. Yes, the Tleilaxu did loathsome things. If one let down the barriers to artificial insemination was the next step, a Tleilaxu one, controlled mutation. Paul, observing the play of emotion around him, felt abruptly that he no longer knew these people. He could see only strangers. Even Alia was a stranger. Alia said,
"If we set the Atreides' genes adrift in a Bene Gesserit river, who knows what may result?"
Gaius Helen Mohiam's head snapped around and she met Alia's gaze. For a flashing instant, they were two Reverend Mothers together, communing on a single thought. What lay behind any Tleilaxu action? The Gola was a Tleilaxu thing. Had he put this plan into Paul's mind?
Would Paul attempt to bargain directly with the Bene Tleilax?
She broke her gaze from Alia's, feeling her own ambivalence and inadequacies. The pitfall of Bene Gesserit training, she reminded herself, lay in the powers granted. Such powers predisposed one to vanity and pride. But power deluded those who used it. One tended to believe power could overcome any barrier, including one's own ignorance. Only one thing stood paramount here for the Bene Gesserit, she told herself. That was the pyramid of generations which had reached an apex in Paul Atreides and in his abomination of a sister. A wrong choice here, and the pyramid would have to be rebuilt, starting generations back in the parallel lines and with breeding specimens lacking the choicest characteristics.
Controlled mutation, she thought. Did the Tleilaxu really practice it? How tempting.
She shook her head, the better to rid it of such thoughts.
You reject my proposal? Paul asked. I'm thinking, she said.
And again she looked at the sister. The optimum cross for this female Atreides had been lost, killed by Paul. Another possibility remained, however, one which would cement the desired characteristic into an offspring. Paul dared offer animal breeding to the Bene Gesserit. How much was he really prepared to pay for his Cheney's life? Would he accept a cross with his own sister? Sparring for time, the Reverend Mother said,
Tell me, O flawless exemplar of all that's holy, has Irulan anything to say of your proposal?
Irulan will do what you tell her to do, Paul growled.
True enough, Mohiam thought.
She firmed her jaw, offered a new gambit.
There are two Atreides.
Paul, sensing something of what lay in the old witch's mind, felt blood darken his face.
Careful what you suggest, he said.
You just use Irulan to gain your own ends, eh? She asked.
Wasn't she trained to be used? Paul asked.
And we trained her, that's what he's saying, Mohiam thought. Well, Irulan's a divided coin. Was there another way to spend such a coin? Will you put Cheney's child on the throne? The Reverend Mother asked.
On my throne, Paul said.
He glanced at Alia, wondering suddenly if she knew the divergent possibilities in this exchange. Alia stood with eyes closed, an odd stillness of person about her. With what inner force did she commune? Seeing his sister thus, Paul felt he'd been cast adrift. Alia stood on a shore that was receding from him. The Reverend Mother made her decision, said,
This is too much for one person to decide. I must consult with my council on Wallach. Will you permit a message?
As though she needed my permission, Paul thought.
He said, Agreed then, but don't delay too long. I will not sit idly by while you debate.
Will you bargain with the Bene Tleilax? The Gola asked, his voice a sharp intrusion.
Alia's eyes popped open and she stared at the Gola as though she'd been wakened by a dangerous intruder.
I've made no such decision, Paul said. What I will do is go into the desert as soon as it can be arranged. Our child will be born in Sietch.
A wise decision, Stilgar intoned.
Alia refused to look at Stilgar. It was a wrong decision. She could feel this in every cell. Paul must know it. Why had he fixed himself upon such a path?
Have the Bene Tleilax offered their services? Alia asked.
She saw Mohiam hanging on the answer. Paul shook his head.
No.
He glanced at Stilgar.
Still, arrange for the message to be sent to Wallach.
At once, my lord.
Paul turned away, waited while Stilgar summoned guards, left with the old witch. He sensed Alia debating whether to confront him with more questions. She turned instead to the Gola.
Mentat, she said, will the Tleilaxu bid for favor with my brother?
The Gola shrugged. Paul felt his attention wander.
The Tleilaxu? No, not in the way Alia meant.
Her question revealed, though, that she had not seen the alternatives here. Well, vision varied from Sibyl to Sibyl, Why not a variance from brother to sister? Wandering, wandering. He came back from each thought with a start to pick up shards of the nearby conversations. Must know what the Tlelaxu. The fullness of data is always. Healthy doubts were... Paul turned, looked at his sister, caught her attention. He knew she would see tears on his face and wonder at them. Let her wonder. Wondering was a kindness now. He glanced at the Gola, seeing only Duncan Idaho despite the metallic eyes. Sorrow and compassion warred in Paul. What might those metal eyes record? There are many degrees of sight and many degrees of blindness, Paul thought. His mind turned to a paraphrase of the passage from the Orange Catholic Bible. What senses do we lack that we cannot see another world all around us? Were those metal eyes another sense than sight? Alia crossed to her brother, sensing his utter sadness. She touched a tear on his cheek with a Fremen gesture of awe, said, "We must not grieve for those dear to us before their passing."
"Before their passing," Paul whispered. "Tell me, little sister, what is before?"
"I've had a bellyful of the god and priest business. You think I don't see my own mythos? Consult your data once more, hate. I've insinuated my rights into the most elementary human acts. The people eat in the name of Muad'Dib. They make love in my name, are born in my name, cross the street in my name. A roof beam cannot be raised in the lowliest hovel of far Ganga Shri without invoking the blessing of Muad'Dib." Book of Diatribes. From The Hate Chronicle.
"You risk much leaving your post and coming to me here at this time,"
Edric said, glaring through the walls of his tank at the face dancer.
"How weak and narrow is your thinking," Cytail said. "Who is it who comes to visit you?"
Edric hesitated, observing the hulk shape, heavy eyelids, blunt face. It was early in the day, and Edric's metabolism had not yet cycled from night repose into full melange consumption.
"This is not the shape which walked the streets?"
Edric asked.
"One would not look twice at some of the figures I have been today," Cytail said.
"The chameleon thinks a change of shape will hide him from anything,"
Edric thought with rare insight, and he wondered if his presence in the conspiracy truly hid them from all oracular powers. The Emperor's sister, now. Edric shook his head, stirring the orange gas of his tank, said,
"Why are you here?"
"The gift must be prodded to swifter action," Cytail said.
"That cannot be done."
"A way must be found," Cytail insisted.
"Why?"
"Things are not to my liking. The Emperor is trying to split us. Already he has made his bid to the Bene Gesserit."
"Oh, that.
That. You must prod the Gola to—"
"You fashioned him, Tlelaxu," Edric said. "You know better than to ask this."
He paused, moved closer to the transparent wall of his tank.
"Or did you lie to us about this gift?"
"Lie?"
"You said the weapon was to be aimed and released, nothing more. Once the Gola was given, we could not tamper."
"Any Gola can be disturbed," Cytail said. "You need do nothing more than question him about his original being."
"What will this do?"
"It will stir him to actions which will serve our purposes."
"He is a Mentat with powers of logic and reason," Edric objected. "He may guess what I'm doing. Or the sister. If her attention is focused upon—"
"Do you hide us from the Sibyl or don't you?" Cytail asked.
"I'm not afraid of oracles," Edric said. "I'm concerned with logic, with real spies, with the physical powers of the Imperium, with the control of the spice, with—"
"One can contemplate the Emperor and his powers comfortably, if one remembers that all things are finite," Cytail said.
Oddly, the steersman recoiled in agitation, threshing his limbs like some weird newt. Cytail fought a sense of loathing at the sight. The guild navigator wore his usual dark leotard bulging at the belt with various containers, yet he gave the impression of nakedness when he moved. It was the swimming, reaching movements, Cytail decided, and he was struck once more by the delicate linkages of their conspiracy. They were not a compatible group. That was weakness. Edric's agitation subsided. He stared out at Cytale, vision coloured by the orange gas which sustained him. What plot did the face dancer hold in reserve to save himself? Edric wondered. That Leilaxu was not acting in a predictable fashion. Evil omen. Something in the navigator's voice and actions told Cytale that the guildsman feared the sister more than the emperor. This was an abrupt thought flashed on the screen of awareness. Disturbing. Had they overlooked something important about Alia? Would the Gola be sufficient weapon to destroy both?
You know what is said of Alia? Cytale asked, probing.
What do you mean?
Again the fishman was agitated.
Never have philosophy and culture had such a patroness, Cytale said. Pleasure and beauty unite in...
What is enduring about beauty and pleasure? Edric demanded. We will destroy both, Atreides. Culture. They dispense culture the better to rule. Beauty. They promote the beauty which enslaves. They create illiterate ignorance, easiest thing of all. They leave nothing to chance. Chains. Everything they do forges chains, enslaves. But slaves always revolt.
The sister may wed and produce offspring, Cytale said.
Why do you speak of the sister?
Edric asked.
The emperor may choose a mate for her, Cytale said.
Let him choose. Already it is too late.
Even you cannot invent the next moment, Cytale warned. You are not a creator, any more than are the Atreides.
He nodded.
We must not presume too much.
We aren't the ones to flap our tongues about creation, Edric protested. We aren't the rabble trying to make a messiah out of Muad'Dib. What is this nonsense? Why are you raising such questions?
It's this planet, Cytale said. It raises questions.
Planets don't speak.
This one does.
Oh?
It speaks of creation. Sand blowing in the night, that is creation.
Sand blowing?
When you awaken, the first light shows you the new world, all fresh and ready for your tracks.
Untracked sand? Edric thought. Creation?
He felt knotted with sudden anxiety. The confinement of his tank, the surrounding room, everything closed in upon him, constricted him.
Tracks in sand. You talk like a Fremen,
Edric said.
This is a Fremen thought and it's instructive, Cytale agreed. They speak of Muad'Dib's jihad as leaving tracks in the universe in the same way that a Fremen tracks new sand. They've marked out a trail in men's lives.
So?
Another night comes, Cytale said. Winds blow.
Yes, Edric said. The jihad is finite. Muad'Dib has used his jihad and...
He didn't use the jihad, Cytale said. The jihad used him. I think he would have stopped it if he could.
If he could? All he had to do was...
Oh, be still, Cytale barked. You can't stop a mental epidemic. It leaps from person to person across parsecs. It's overwhelmingly contagious. It strikes at the unprotected side in the place where we lodge the fragments of other such plagues. Who can stop such a thing? Muad'Dib hasn't the antidote. The thing has roots in chaos. Can orders reach there?
Have you been infected, then?
Edric asked. He turned slowly in the orange gas, wondering why Cytale's words carried such a tone of fear. Had the face dancer broken from the conspiracy? There was no way to peer into the future and examine this now. The future had become a muddy stream clogged with prophets.
We're all contaminated, Cytale said,
and he reminded himself that Edric's intelligence had severe limits. How could this point be made that the guildsman would understand it?
But when we destroy him, Edric said, the contagion...
I should leave you in this ignorance, Cytale said, but my duties will not permit it. Besides, it's dangerous to all of us.
Edric recoiled, steadied himself with a kick of one webbed foot which sent the orange gas whipping around his legs.
"You speak strangely," he said.
"This whole thing is explosive," Cytel said, in a calmer voice. "It's ready to shatter. When it goes, it will send bits of itself out through the centuries. Don't you see this?"
"We've dealt with religions before," Edric protested. "If this new..."
"It is not just a religion," Cytel said, wondering what the Reverend Mother would say to this harsh education of their fellow conspirator. "Religious government is something else.
Wadib has crowded his Kizarat in everywhere,
displaced the old functions of government. But he has no permanent civil service, no interlocking embassies. He has bishoprics, islands of authority. At the center of each island is a man. Men learn how to gain and hold personal power. Men are jealous."
"When they're divided, we'll absorb them one by one," Edric said with a complacent smile. "Cut off the head and the body will fall to—"
"This body has two heads," Cytel said.
"The sister, who may wed."
"Who will certainly wed."
"I don't like your tone, Cytel."
"And I don't like your ignorance."
"What if she does wed? Will that shake our plans?"
"It will shake the universe."
"But they're not unique. I myself possess powers which—"
"You're an infant. You toddle where they stride."
"They are not unique."
"You forget, guildsman, that we once made a Kwisatz Haderach. This is a being filled by the spectacle of time. It is a form of existence which cannot be threatened without enclosing yourself in the identical threat. Wadib knows we would attack his Cheney. We must move faster than we have. You must get to the Gola, prod him as I have instructed."
"And if I do not?"
"We will feel the thunderbolt."
Oh, worm of many teeth, canst thou deny what has no cure? The flesh and breath which lure thee to the ground of all beginnings feed on monsters twisting in a door of fire. Thou hast no robe in all thy attire to cover intoxications of divinity or hide the burnings of desire. Worm Song from the Dune Book. Paul had worked up a sweat on the practice floor using Chris' knife and short sword against the Gola. He stood now at a window looking down into the temple plaza, tried to imagine the scene with Cheney at the clinic. She'd been taken ill at mid-morning, the sixth week of her pregnancy. The medics were the best. They'd call when they had news. Murky afternoon sand clouds darkened the sky over the plaza. Fremen called such weather dirty air. Would the medics never call? Each second struggled past, reluctant to enter his universe. Waiting. Waiting. The Bene Gesserit sent no word from Wallach. Deliberately delaying, of course. Prescient vision had recorded these moments, but he shielded his awareness from the oracle, preferring the role here of a timefish swimming not where he willed, but where the currents carried him. Destiny permitted no struggles now. The Gola could be heard racking weapons, examining the equipment. Paul sighed, put a hand to his own belt, deactivated his shield. The tingling passage of its field ran down against his skin. He'd face events when Cheney came, Paul told himself, time enough then to accept the fact that what he'd concealed from her had prolonged her life. Was it evil, he wondered, to prefer Cheney to an heir? But what right did he make her choice for her? Foolish thoughts. Who could hesitate, given the alternatives? Slave pits, torture, agonizing sorrow, and worse. He heard the door open, Cheney's footsteps. Paul turned. Murder sat on Cheney's face. The wide Fremen belt which gathered the waist of her golden robe, the water rings worn as a necklace, one hand at her hip, never far from the knife, the trenchant stare which was her first inspection of any room. Everything about her stood now only as a background for violence. He opened his arms as she came to him, gathered her close.
"Someone," she rasped, speaking against his breast. has been feeding me a contraceptive for a long time, before I began the new diet. There'll be problems with this birth because of it.
But there are remedies?
He asked.
Dangerous remedies. I know the source of that poison. I'll have her blood.
My Sihaya, he whispered, holding her close to calm a sudden trembling.
You'll bear the heir we want. Isn't that enough? My life burns faster, she said, pressing against him. The birth now controls my life. The medics told me it goes at a terrible pace. I must eat and eat, and take more spice as well. Eat it, drink it. I'll kill her for this.
Paul kissed her cheek.
No, my Sihaya, you'll kill no one.
And he thought, Irulan prolonged your life, beloved. For you, the time of birth is the time of death. He felt hidden grief drain his marrow then, empty his life into a black flask. Cheney pushed away from him.
She cannot be forgiven.
Who said anything about forgiving?
Then why shouldn't I kill her?
It was such a flat, Fremen question that Paul felt himself almost overcome by a hysterical desire to laugh. He covered it by saying, It wouldn't help.
You've seen that?
Paul felt his belly tighten with vision memory. What I've seen, what I've seen, he muttered. Every aspect of surrounding events fitted a present which paralyzed him. He felt chained to a future which, exposed too often, had locked onto him like a greedy succubus. Tight dryness clogged his throat. Had he followed the witch call of his own oracle, he wondered, until it had spilled him into a merciless present?
Tell me what you've seen, Cheney said.
I can't.
Why mustn't I kill her?
Because I ask it. He watched her accept this. She did it the way sand accepted water, absorbing and concealing. Was there obedience beneath that hot, angry surface? He wondered. And he realized then that life in the Royal Keep had left Cheney unchanged. She'd merely stopped here for a time, inhabited a way station on a journey with her man. Nothing of the desert had been taken from her. Cheney stepped away from him then, glanced at the Gola who stood waiting near the diamond circle of the practice door.
You've been crossing blades with him?
She asked. And I'm better for it. Her gaze went to the circle on the floor, back to the Gola's metallic eyes.
I don't like it, she said.
He's not intended to do me violence, Paul said.
You've seen that?
I've not seen it.
Then how do you know?
Because he's more than Gola. He's Duncan Idaho.
The Bene Tlelaks made him?
They made more than they intended. She shook her head. A corner of her Nejone scarf rubbed the collar of her robe.
How can you change the fact that he is a Gola?
Hate, Paul said. Are you the tool of my undoing? If the substance of here and now is changed, the future is changed, the Gola said.
That is no answer, Cheney objected.
Paul raised his voice. How will I die, Hate? Light glinted from the artificial eyes. It is said, my lord, that you will die of money and power. Cheney stiffened.
How dare he speak thus to you?
The Mentat is truthful, Paul said.
Was Duncan Idaho a real friend?
She asked. He gave his life for me.
It is sad, Cheney whispered, that a Gola cannot be restored to his original being.
Would you convert me? The Gola asked, directing his gaze to Cheney.
What does he mean? Cheney asked.
To be converted is to be turned around, Paul said. But there's no going back. Every man carries his own past with him, Haight said. And every Gola? Paul asked. In a way, my lord. Then what of that past in your secret flesh? Paul asked. Cheney saw how the question disturbed the Gola. His movements quickened, hands clenched into fists. She glanced at Paul, wondering why he probed thus. Was there a way to restore this creature to the man he'd been?
Has Egola ever remembered his real past?
Cheney asked.
Many attempts have been made, Haight said, his gaze fixed on the floor near his feet. No Gola has ever been restored to his former being.
But you long for this to happen, Paul said.
The blank surfaces of the Gola's eyes came up to center on Paul with a pressing intensity.
Yes.
Voice soft, Paul said,
if there's a way.
This flesh, Haight said, touching left hand to forehead in a curious saluting movement, is not the flesh of my original birth. It is reborn. Only the shape is familiar. A face dancer might do as well.
Not as well, Paul said, and you're not a face dancer.
That is true, my lord.
Whence comes your shape?
The genetic imprint of the original cells.
Somewhere, Paul said, there's a plastic something which remembers the shape of Duncan Idaho. It said the ancients probed this region before the Butlerian Jihad. What's the extent of this memory, Haight? What did it learn from the original?
The Gola shrugged.
What if he wasn't Idaho?
Cheney asked.
He was.
Can you be certain?
She asked.
He is Duncan in every aspect. I cannot imagine a force strong enough to hold that shape thus, without any relaxation or any deviation.
My lord, Haight objected, because we cannot imagine a thing, that doesn't exclude it from reality. There are things I must do as a Gola that I would not do as a man.
Keeping his attention on Cheney, Paul said,
you see?
She nodded. Paul turned away, fighting deep sadness. He crossed to the balcony windows, drew the draperies. Lights came on in the sudden gloom. He pulled the sash of his robe tight, listened for sounds behind him. Nothing. He turned. Cheney stood as though entranced, her gaze centered on the Gola. Haight, Paul saw, had retreated to some inner chamber of his being, had gone back to the Gola place. Cheney turned at the sound of Paul's return. She still felt the thraldom of the instant Paul had precipitated. For a brief moment, the Gola had been an intense, vital human being. For that moment, he had been someone she did not fear, indeed someone she liked and admired. Now she understood Paul's purpose in this probing. He had wanted her to see the man in the Gola flesh. She stared at Paul.
That man... was that Duncan Idaho?
That was Duncan Idaho. He is still there.
Would he have allowed Irulan to go on living?
Cheney asked. The water didn't sink too deep, Paul thought. And he said, if I commanded it?
I don't understand, she said. Shouldn't you be angry?
I am angry.
You don't sound angry. You sound sorrowful.
He closed his eyes.
Yes, that too.
You're my man, she said. I know this, but suddenly I don't understand you.
Abruptly, Paul felt that he walked down a long cavern. His flesh moved, one foot and then another, but his thoughts went elsewhere.
I don't understand myself, he whispered.
When he opened his eyes, he found that he had moved away from Cheney. She spoke from somewhere behind him.
Beloved, I'll not ask again what you've seen. I only know I'm to give you the air we want.
He nodded, then, I've known that from the beginning. He turned, studied her. Cheney seemed very far away. She drew herself up, placed a hand on her abdomen.
I'm hungry. The medics tell me I must eat 3 or 4 times what I ate before. I'm frightened, beloved. It goes too fast.
Too fast, he agreed. This fetus knows the necessity for speed.
The audacious nature of Muad'Dib's actions may be seen in the fact that he knew from the beginning whither he was bound, yet not once did he step aside from that path. He put it clearly when he said, I tell you that I have come now to my time of testing, when it will be shown that I am the ultimate servant. Thus he weaves all into one, that both friend and foe may worship him. It is for this reason, and this reason only, that his apostles prayed, Lord, save us from the other paths which Muad'Dib covered with the waters of his life. Those other paths may be imagined only with the deepest revulsion. From the Iyam el-Din, Book of Judgment. The messenger was a young woman, her face, name, and family known to Cheney, which was how she'd penetrated Imperial security. Cheney had done no more than identify her for a security officer named Banerjee, who then arranged the meeting with Muad'Dib. Banerjee acted out of instinct and the assurance that the young woman's father had been a member of the Emperor's death commandos, the dreaded Fadaikin, in the days before the jihad. Otherwise he might have ignored her plea that her message was intended only for the ears of Muad'Dib. She was, of course, screened and searched before the meeting in Paul's private office. Even so, Banerjee accompanied her, hand on knife, other hand on her arm. It was almost midday when they brought her into the room. An odd space, mixture of desert Fremen and family aristocrat. Hyreg hangings lined three walls, delicate tapestries adorned with figures out of Fremen mythology. A view screen covered the fourth wall, a silver-grey surface behind an oval desk whose top held only one object, a Fremen sand clock built with an orrery. The orrery, a suspensor mechanism from Ix, carried both moons of Arrakis in the classic worm trine aligned with the sun. Paul, standing beside the desk, glanced at Banerjee. The security officer was one of those who'd come up through the Fremen constabulary, winning his place on brains and proven loyalty despite the smuggler ancestry attested by his name. He was a solid figure, almost fat. Wisps of black hair fell down over the dark, wet-appearing skin of his forehead like the crest of an exotic bird. His eyes were blue-blue and steady in a gaze which could look upon happiness or atrocity without change of expression. Both Cheney and Stilgar trusted him. Paul knew that if he told Banerjee to throttle the girl immediately, Banerjee would do it.
"Sire, here is the messenger girl," Banerjee said. "M'lady Cheney said she sent word to you."
"Yes," Paul nodded curtly. Oddly, the girl didn't look at him. Her attention remained on the orrery. She was dark-skinned, of medium height, her figure concealed beneath a robe whose rich wine fabric and simple cut spoke of wealth. Her blue-black hair was held in a narrow band of material which matched the robe. The robe concealed her hands. Paul suspected that the hands were tightly clasped. It would be in character. Everything about her would be in character, including the robe, a last piece of finery saved for such a moment. Paul motioned Banerjee aside. He hesitated before obeying. Now the girl moved, one step forward. When she moved, there was grace. Still, her eyes avoided him. Paul cleared his throat. Now the girl lifted her gaze, the whiteless eyes widening with just the right shade of awe. She had an odd little face with delicate chin, a sense of reserve in the way she held her small mouth. The eyes appeared abnormally large above slanted cheeks. There was a cheerless air about her, something which said she seldom smiled. The corners of her eyes even held a faint yellow misting, which could have been from dust irritation or the tracery of Semuta. Everything was in character. "You asked to see me," Paul said. The moment of supreme test for this girl shape had come. Cytale had put on the shape, the mannerisms, the sex, the voice, everything his abilities could grasp and assume. But this was a female known to Muad'Dib in the Sietch days. She'd been a child then, but she and Muad'Dib shared common experiences. Certain areas of memory must be avoided delicately. It was the most exacting part Cytale had ever attempted.
"I am Othaim's Lichna of Berkad'Dib."
The girl's voice came out small, but firm, giving name, father, and pedigree. Paul nodded. He saw how Cheney had been fooled. The timbre of voice, everything reproduced with exactitude. Had it not been for his own Bene Gesserit training in voice, and for the web of Tao in which oracular vision enfolded him, this face-dancer disguise might have gulled even him. Training exposed certain discrepancies. The girl was older than her known years. Too much control tuned the vocal cords. Set of neck and shoulders missed by a fraction the subtle hauteur of Fremen poise. But there were niceties, too. The rich robe had been patched to betray actual status, and the features were beautifully exact. They spoke a certain sympathy of this face dancer for the role being played. "Rest in my home, daughter of Othheim," Paul said in formal Fremen greeting. "You are welcome as water after a dry crossing." The faintest of relaxations exposed the confidence this apparent acceptance had conveyed.
"I bring a message," she said.
"A man's messenger is as himself," Paul said. Saitel breathed softly. It went well, but now came the crucial task. The Atreides must be guided onto that special path. He must lose his Fremen concubine in circumstances where no other shared the blame. The failure must belong only to the omnipotent Muad'Dib. He had to be led into an ultimate realization of his failure, and thence to acceptance of the Tlelaxu alternative.
"I am the smoke which banishes sleep in the night," Saitel said, employing a Fedaikin code phrase, "I bear bad tidings."
Paul fought to maintain calmness. He felt naked, his soul abandoned in a groping time concealed from every vision. Powerful oracles hid this face dancer. Only the edges of these moments were known to Paul. He knew only what he could not do. He could not slay this face dancer. That would precipitate the future which must be avoided at all cost. Somehow, a way must be found to reach into the darkness and change the terrifying pattern.
"Give me your message," Paul said.
Banerjee moved to place himself where he could watch the girl's face. She seemed to notice him for the first time, and her gaze went to the knife handle beneath the security officer's hand.
"The innocent do not believe in evil," she said, looking squarely at Banerjee.
"Ah, well done," Paul thought. It was what the real Lichner would have said. He felt a momentary pang for the real daughter of Othheim, dead now, a corpse in the sand. There was no time for such emotions, though. He scowled. Banerjee kept his attention on the girl.
"I was told to deliver my message in secret," she said.
"Why?"
Banerjee demanded, voice harsh, probing.
"Because it is my father's wish."
"This is my friend," Paul said. "Am I not a Fremen? Then my friend may hear anything I hear."
Saitel composed the girl's shape. Was this a true Fremen custom? Or was it a test?
"The Emperor may make his own rules," Saitel said. "This is the message. My father wishes you to come to him, bringing Chaney."
"Why must I bring Chaney?"
"She is your woman and a Sayadina. This is a water matter by the rules of our tribes. She must attest it that my father speaks according to the Fremen way."
There truly are Fremen in the conspiracy, Paul thought. This moment fitted the shape of things to come for sure, and he had no alternative but to commit himself to this course.
"Of what will your father speak?" Paul asked.
"He will speak of a plot against you, a plot among the Fremen."
"Why doesn't he bring that message in person?" Banerjee demanded.
She kept her gaze on Paul.
"My father cannot come here. The plotters suspect him. He'd not survive the journey."
"Could he not divulge the plot to you?" Banerjee asked. "How came he to risk his daughter on such a mission?"
"The details are locked in a distrans carrier that only Muad'Dib may open," she said. "This much I know."
"Why not send the distrans then?" Paul asked.
"It is a human distrans," she said.
"I'll go then," Paul said. "But I'll go alone."
"Chaney must come with you."
"Chaney is with child."
"When has a Fremen woman refused to—"
"My enemies fed her a subtle poison," Paul said. "It will be a difficult birth. Her health will not permit her to accompany me now."
Before Saitel could still them, Strange emotions passed over the girl features, frustration, anger. Saitel was reminded that every victim must have a way of escape, even such a one as Muad'Dib. The conspiracy had not failed, though. This Atreides remained in the net. He was a creature who had developed firmly into one pattern. He'd destroy himself before changing into the opposite of that pattern. That had been the way with the Tlelaxu Kwisatz Haderach. It would be the way with this one. And then, the Gola.
"Let me ask Cheney to decide this," she said.
"I have decided it," Paul said. "You will accompany me in Cheney's stead."
"It requires a Sayyadina of the right."
"Are you not Cheney's friend?"
Boxed, Saitel thought. Does he suspect? No, he's being Fremen cautious, and the contraceptive is a fact. Well, there are other ways.
"My father told me I was not to return," Saitel said, "that I was to seek asylum with you. He said you'd not risk me."
Paul nodded. It was beautifully in character. He couldn't deny this asylum. She'd plead Fremen obedience to a father's command.
"I'll take Stilgar's wife, Hera," Paul said. "You'll tell us the way to your father."
"How do you know you can trust Stilgar's wife?"
"I know it."
"But I don't."
Paul pursed his lips, then,
"Does your mother live?"
"My true mother has gone to Shai Hulud. My second mother still lives and cares for my father." "Why?"
"She's Osiech Tabor?"
"Yes."
"I remember her," Paul said. "She will serve in Cheney's place."
He motioned to Banerjee. "Have attendants take Othheim's Lichna to suitable quarters." Banerjee nodded. Attendants. The key word meant that this messenger must be put under special guard. He took her arm. She resisted.
"How will you go to my father?"
she pleaded.
"You'll describe the way to Banerjee," Paul said. "He is my friend."
"No, my father has commanded it. I cannot."
"Banerjee," Paul said.
Banerjee paused. Paul saw the man searching that encyclopedic memory which had helped bring him to his position of trust.
"I know a guide who can take you to Othheim,"